Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Peter Prontsos, professor of political science, who discusses the origins and consequences of the Greek financial crisis, as well as alternatives to the austerity policies that have provoked widespread resistance. Robert Naiman of the group Just Foreign Policy, who talks about steps taken by the Greek government to block international activists from launching their freedom flotilla to challenge the Israeli blockade of Gaza. And David Leopold, past president of the American Immigration Lawyers Association, who discusses legal challenges to harsh state anti-immigration laws and the urgent need for comprehensive federal immigration reform. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The youthful pro-democracy activists who played a central role in overthrowing Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak are now pressing to delay planned elections for September until a new constitution is approved. Among the reformers, there is a growing fear that the Muslim Brotherhood and powerful elements of Mubarak's National Democratic Party will dominate the election and derail opportunities for reform. There are also mounting fears the Muslim Brotherhood, founded in 1928, would impose a harsh Islamic state. According to the Los Angeles Times, the military brass that currently rules Egypt wants to hand off power to newly elected leaders while holding on to institutional power. In March, 77% of voters approved holding early elections and amending the current constitution. Now, pro-democracy activists want to reverse the process by writing a new constitution before elections. The goal is to limit the influence of the Muslim Brotherhood and National Democratic Party power brokers. Activists are organizing new protests for July 8th and working to collect 15 million signatures to delay the upcoming election. Among Muslim Brotherhood leaders, there is a growing split between old guard and youth factions. Human rights groups have criticized the Brotherhood for recent criticisms leveled at women and Coptic Christians. Yet most Egyptian commentators expect the Muslim Brotherhood to play a central role in the new government until a unified civil society opposition party emerges to challenge established power centers. Classified U.S. State Department cables revealed by WikiLeaks show that American diplomats in Haiti worked closely with garment contractors to undermine Haiti's campaign to raise the minimum wage in 2008 and 2009. In alliance with garment factory owners, the U.S. Agency for International Development distributed a study showing a sharp rise in the minimum wage would wreck the textile industry. The Haitian factory owners refused to pay a 62-cent-an-hour increase in the minimum wage approved by the Haitian parliament. Instead, the owners, who make clothing for Fruit of the Loom, Hanes, and Levi's, agreed to pay only a 9-cents-per-hour increase, lifting the factory wage to 36 cents an hour. To resolve the impasse, the U.S. State Department urged Haitian President René Préval to intervene or risk political chaos. In August 2009, President Préval offered a compromise, create a two-tiered wage structure, $3 a day for those working in the garment industry and $5 a day for workers in other industries. Yet that was not enough for David Lindwall, deputy head of the U.S. mission in Haiti, who complained in cables that the new $5 a day minimum wage did not take economic reality into account and was simply a political appeal to the unemployed and underpaid masses. According to The Nation magazine, a year before the massive January 2010 earthquake devastated the island nation, Haiti was the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, with over 3.3 million people at risk of hunger. The Federal Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals in Cincinnati has upheld the Obama administration's health care reform law. The court concluded the law did not violate the Commerce Clause in the U.S. Constitution. The health care law passed in March 2010 aims to provide health insurance for 30 million uninsured Americans. The mandate to buy insurance begins in 2014. It is based on a similar program in Massachusetts pushed through by then-Governor Mitt Romney, who is now the leading GOP candidate for president. In a split 2-1 decision, the court rejected the appeal by the Thomas Merton Center in Michigan, a Christian-based law firm. The majority included Judge Jeffrey Sutton, a conservative Republican and former law clerk to Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. Walter Dellinger, a U.S. Solicitor General in the Clinton administration, called the appeals court decision a complete vindication for the Obama health care law. Two other appeals courts in Atlanta and Richmond, Virginia, are considering lawsuits against the health care reform law. The U.S. Supreme Court is expected to take up the case when its new term begins in October. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
After weeks of widespread, sometimes violent protests, the Greek parliament passed legislation on June 30th, authorizing austerity measures and a privatization plan that were required to secure emergency funding from the European Union to prevent the nation from defaulting on its debt. The majority of demonstrators were peaceful, but a small number of protesters fought running street battles with police that shattered windows in storefronts in central Athens. A slogan among anti-austerity protesters in Greece and across Europe is, "We won't pay for their crisis," embodying the sentiment among many Greeks who say they are suffering massive layoffs, privatization of national assets, and wage and pension cuts to protect European bankers. Protesters and some economists are concerned that the austerity budgets imposed on Greece and other European nations in financial crisis, such as Spain, Portugal, and Ireland, will further weaken these economies, making it more difficult for governments to pay down their debt. Greece's debt is now estimated at more than 2.5 times the country's gross domestic product, according to Global Finance magazine. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Peter Prontsos, professor of political science at Langara College in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Speaking from an airport, Professor Prontsos discusses the origins and consequences of the Greek financial crisis, as well as alternatives to the austerity policies that have provoked widespread anger and resistance.
One of the things that I think is really important to remember is that in reality, the crisis really wasn't caused by the Greek people so much as the elites in Greece and in Europe. There were a whole lot of factors that went into it. One of the problems is that the Greek government is not very efficient, and one of the things they've been letting go on for a long time, for decades actually, is that a lot of people, especially the wealthy, just don't pay their taxes. I've heard about literally thousands of doctors who pay no taxes because they essentially get paid cash, and they tell the government, well, they only made, you know, $12,000 a year or something. So there's a huge deficit when it comes to having the revenues to pay off their debt. Another huge problem was when the Wall Street recession hit in 2008. One of the things that it did was to drive Greece into recession, which meant there were more people in unemployment, the economy was hurt, and their debt went up. And so now they're faced with a pretty enormous debt. It's about 113% of their GDP. And a lot of the banks who gambled on the bonds and thought they could make, guaranteed profits on it, are worried that they'll ever get paid back, hence the need for the bailout.
Tell our listeners a bit about your cousin, Maria, and the pain that she's personally feeling from these cuts.
Okay. My cousin Maria lives in a small town called Silocastro, and she's been a high school teacher for about 26 years now. And when the first austerity came in last year, her pay, which was only around $2,000 U.S., a month for a full-time teacher, and those of us who teach know it's more than full-time, her salary was cut something like 20%. So she's getting $1,500 or $1,600 a month now for full-time work. When teachers and clerks and so on find either their jobs disappearing or their pay being cut, well, they're going to spend less in the economy. So more shops close and more people are laid off, and they can't spend any money either, and so on and so on. And it's a recipe for increasing misery and suffering, and not a recipe that provides a stimulus to get the economy going again. I mean, a really good example of what will work was the United States. When the Great Depression was on, a lot of things were tried, but it wasn't until the U.S. said, essentially, the heck with the deficit, we have a war to fight, Public spending, of course, increased. Unemployment disappeared overnight. And the U.S. economy came out of the Second World War the strongest in the world. Something similar is needed in Greece in terms, first of all, of debt reduction. Some of it has to be just written off. I mean, the speculators who bought the bonds were essentially gambling. They were risking their, you know, their money in investment. So if the investment goes bad under, you know, basic economics, they lose, you know, part of the investment. The other thing is the remaining debt could be restructured. So instead of having to be paid back over, you know, 4, 5, 10 years, maybe make it 20 years. So something that's actually doable. And then the final aspect would be for the European Union to provide some aid to get people back to work, to get the economy going. And then guess what? As the economy picks up, as taxes, tax revenue picks up, Greece can pay off its debts.
We have seen some very militant and angry protests in the streets of Greece, in Athens in particular, people very angry and believing that the austerity asked of the Greek people is unsustainable. Where are those protests leading, in your view? Are some of the alternatives you just discussed, are they possible for the Greek people to demand of their government and the European Union as a whole?
There's something called the Troika, which is the three leading branches that are forcing these conditions on Greece, the European Commission, the IMF, and the European Central Bank. Now, what I'm hoping is that with the resistance of Greeks and others, Spaniards, Italians, Portuguese, and so on, creating enough opposition so that the European Troika says, okay, this is not going to work, and they recognize the danger of a default, which again, as I said, could threaten, some people say it could threaten the entire European Union project. They might say, okay, we're going to have to make some sacrifices. The biggest sacrifices would be made by banks in France and Germany and a little bit in Britain. The U.S. doesn't seem to have many deposits or bonds from Greece. They would have to accept a longer term to be paid back and probably forgiveness of some of the debts. One thing to keep in mind is the Greek gross domestic product is only about 3% of the European Union. So helping them out and actually providing funds to rescue the economy is not that big of a deal in terms of the European economy. What you have, though, are essentially banks and bondholders and insurance companies who just don't want to take any losses at all. So they will fight to the end to try and maintain this grip on Greece and squeeze as much blood out of Greek people as they can.
That was Peter Prontzos, professor of political science at Langara College in Vancouver, British Columbia. For more commentary on the Greek debt crisis, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. 10 boats containing hundreds of solidarity activists pledged to nonviolence make up the Freedom Flotilla that intended to sail to Gaza in order to break the Israeli sea blockade of the Palestinian territory imposed since the Islamic Palestinian Party Hamas took over Gaza in 2007. Gaza is home to 1.5 million people who are often described as living in an open-air prison. But all the flotilla's boats have been confined to Greek ports for more than a week, which government officials say is necessary for their own safety. The captains of both the American and Canadian vessels were arrested after they defied Greek Coast Guard orders not to leave port. Israeli commandos attacked the first Freedom Flotilla in international waters just over a year ago, resulting in the death of 9 unarmed passengers and injuries to dozens more. The worldwide outcry in opposition to the Israeli military's violence against the 2010 8 flotilla caused Israel to liberalize the blockade and allow a limited number of additional civilian goods and supplies to enter the territory. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke by cell phone with Robert Naiman, policy director of the group Just Foreign Policy, and one of 36 passengers aboard the American ship The Audacity of Hope, impounded by Greek authorities. Speaking from Athens, Naiman describes the roadblocks that have been put in the activists' way and some of the alliances that have led Greece and the U.S. to fully support the Israeli position that the anti-blockade flotilla should not sail, and if they do, the boats can justifiably be turned back by force.
It was a political decision that was taken some time ago by people organizing this. Nobody knew, for example, at the time that the government of Greece would be hanging by a thread. They would be facing tremendous pressure from the international financial market, the European Union, the United States International Monetary Fund. And I think that formed part of the context in which this played out.
Greece says it's refusing to allow any boats to leave in order to protect the safety of the passengers, who face real dangers from Israel, which has said it will do whatever is necessary to prevent the boats from breaching the sea blockade of Gaza. That seems kind of like blaming the victims or the potential victims.
It's totally bizarre. There's no precedent in international law. There are international treaties for freedom of movement of the sea. And the government of Greece has no basis, nothing in law that says that the government of Greece can sort of arbitrarily take on itself the responsibility for deciding where we travel. There's supposed to be freedom of movement. You're supposed to be able to go from anywhere to anywhere else. The only thing that's their business is saying whether crafts are seaworthy. And indeed, at the beginning, they pretended that that was the issue. But then we found out late last week that, of course, as many suspected, it wasn't the issue at all. That the political decision was taken by the government of Greece in collaboration with the Israeli and U.S. government to interfere, to block the Bab al-Fatila. And this business about trying to prevent humanitarian disaster or whatever, this is just a lie. It's total nonsense. The real reason is that the government of Greece has taken a political decision to collaborate with the Israeli and U.S. government in blocking the flotilla.
News reports in the U.S. all talk about humanitarian aid being aboard the flotilla boats. I know the U.S. boat specifically does not have any humanitarian aid. Israel says that you guys are just trying to break the blockade and it's not about humanitarian aid. Wouldn't you actually agree with that statement?
Yeah, it's kind of funny that we're being accused of pretending that it's about humanitarian aid when every time we're allowed to speak for ourselves, we say it's not about humanitarian aid. We're part of a flotilla of ships, of 10 ships. Some of the ships are bringing material aid, but our boat is not bringing material aid. Our boat is bringing thousands of letters from Americans to the people of Gaza because we see the issue as political. We see the issue as one of justice and freedom. The people of Gaza are subjected to unjust and illegitimate restrictions by the Israeli military occupation authorities, and we reject those restrictions, and we're protesting those restrictions by challenging Israel's shutdown of Gaza's sea access, shutdown of Gaza's port. So for us, it's not about humanitarian aid. It's true that Gaza does need things that it doesn't have, but that is a symptom of the deeper issue, which is that Gaza doesn't have freedom.
The American boat attempted to leave Athens on Friday, but was immediately turned back by Greek officials, and the captain, John Klusmeier, was arrested and charged with the fairly serious crime of endangering his passengers. What's going on with that?
It's true that our captain has been arrested. We have good legal representation. We think the charges are bogus and have been trumped up, and we're hopeful that the charges will be dropped. We're continuing to press for our boat to be allowed to go, trying to meet the bureaucratic hurdles that the Greek government has placed in our way. We don't know when it will be allowed to leave, but we're going to continue pressing the Greek authorities to allow our boat to go.
Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton said a few weeks ago that those Americans on the Audacity of Hope are on their own in attempting to reach Gaza. In other words, they can expect no support or protection from the American government, and they might even be breaking the law. This sounds like another example of blaming the potential victims.
The State Department is supposed to protect U.S. citizens. It's one of their jobs. And we've seen no protection from the State Department. For example, our captain's been in jail since Friday. He still hasn't received any visit from the U.S. consulate, the U.S. embassy, even though that's his right under international law to have a consular visit. We've seen the public statements that you referred to from the Secretary of State and other U.S. officials basically saying that if the Israeli government attacks us, then we get what we deserve. It's our fault, which is bizarre when you consider that Israeli government officials have conceded that we're unarmed peace activists. So, why the compulsion to use violence against unarmed peace activists, and why does the U.S. government have nothing to say about an Israeli government threat to use military force against unarmed American peace activists? It's quite telling. The contempt of the U.S. government officials and the State Department for our right to protest.
That was Robert Naiman, a passenger aboard the U.S.-flagged Audacity of Hope, part of the international flotilla attempting to sail to Gaza. To learn more about the Gaza flotilla challenging the Israeli blockade, visit our website at btlonline.org. since Arizona's Republican Governor Jan Brewer signed her state's anti-immigration legislation, SB 1070, into law in April 2010, other states across the nation have imposed similar measures. State governments in Utah, Georgia, Indiana, South Carolina, and Alabama have used Arizona's SB 1070 law as a model to craft their own legislation that targets illegal immigrants and allows local police officers to become de facto enforcers of federal immigration laws. The Alabama legislature's HB 56 bill was signed into law by GOP Governor Robert Bentley in June, with the law going into effect this summer. Provisions include a requirement that schools and employers investigate students' and workers' immigration status and criminalization of knowingly renting housing to undocumented workers. Opponents of the measure say the new law will encourage racial profiling against the state's Latino community by requiring police officers to question, under the pretext of reasonable suspicion, the citizenship status of anyone they may come into contact with in the course of their duties. Advocates for immigration reform have branded these state laws as draconian, resulting in fear among undocumented workers and their families, unharvested local crops, and damage to the economy. Lawsuits by civil liberties groups have resulted in portions of some state anti-immigration laws being suspended, pending court action and appeals. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with David Leopold, immediate past president of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. He discusses the impact of these state laws and the urgent need for Congress to take action on comprehensive immigration reform.
Arizona, about a year ago, enacted its own immigration law and did a lot of things that the federal immigration law doesn't do, namely criminalized a lot of people who really shouldn't be criminalized. And it focused on people based on the color of their skin. In all fairness, that's what the law did. It called for racial profiling. In fact, it almost mandated it by some of the lesser-known provisions. And these laws were copycatted in places like Utah, more recently in Georgia, in Indiana. And the most onerous, in fact, they get the prize for the nastiest immigration law in the country, is Alabama. Which, of course, has a history unfortunate history of racial profiling, you know, dating back to the days of the Freedom Rides and the Civil Rights Movement of the 60s, well before that, of course. So what we have is a situation in this country where Congress has failed, frankly, to do its job. It's failed to draft an immigration law to replace the dysfunctional system that we do have. And there's a vacuum, frankly, and the states have really taken up that vacuum, not because they're doing a good thing, but because you've got cynical politicians in places like Arizona, Governor Jan Brewer, who you mentioned, or in Georgia and Utah and some of these other places, that find it politically expedient to legislate draconian laws on the backs of immigrants so that they can get reelected. It's a little bit more complex than that, of course, but that's the phenomenon that's going on right now.
David, as you mentioned before, a lot of politicians are trying to take advantage of the resentment of many white Americans in terms of their personal economic crises during this economic meltdown. And certainly that's provoked a certain sector of the U.S. population to look for scapegoats. Immigrants are a handy scapegoat. But I wonder if you would respond to a lot of their anger, which comes out in terms of accusations that immigrants are taking Americans' jobs, that immigrants are crowding the nation's schools and burdening taxpayers with extra charges, that immigrants are bringing disease into the country and crime into the country. I think anybody listening has heard this litany of charges against immigrants. But maybe you could respond to those generally, if not specifically.
Right. Well, unfortunately, America does have a history of xenophobia or fear of immigrants. The charges that they bring diseases, the charges that they overburden us, the charges that they steal jobs are nothing new. That goes back to the turn of the century. We said that about the Chinese. We said that about the Germans. We said that about the Italians. We've said that in every generation about waves of immigrants. Steal American jobs. That's the biggest one, and that's the allegation that a lot of the anti-immigrant restrictions throw out there because it scares people. I mean, nobody wants to lose their job. First of all, immigration, it's not a zero-sum game in the sense of jobs. It's not a job for a job. It's not an American job goes to an immigrant. The studies, the credible studies, show, and I'm talking about studies out of the Department of Labor, Bureau of Labor Statistics, or places like the Center for American Progress or the Immigration Policy Institute in Washington, and even places like the Cato Institute on the far right of the political spectrum. The studies show that if we really roll up our sleeves and fix the immigration system, then what we're going to do over the next 10 years, the next decade, is add $1.5 to $1.7 trillion in gross domestic product to our economy. That translates into 1 million jobs for U.S. workers, for Americans. That also translates into raising the wages and the working conditions of all Americans. So the economics of this thing are strongly in favor of fixing the immigration system.
Now, what about court challenges to some of these state laws that we've been talking about in Arizona, Utah, Alabama, and others? There's a concern, of course, that if this ends up in the Supreme Court, that this right-wing tilted Supreme Court could rule in favor of each state having its own immigration law. Is that a concern of yours, or how do you think it'll go?
I don't know. If the Supreme Court of the United States, I have to believe that the members of the Supreme Court of the United States are going to fairly review the Constitution as it relates to the immigration law that was passed in Arizona last year, the one that was passed in Utah, the one that was just passed in Alabama. You know, I don't agree with a lot of their decisions. I do think it's a little bit far to the right for my taste. But I do believe that when they take a look at the immigration law coming out of Arizona or out of Alabama, that they're going to be so appalled by the racist nature of these laws that they're going to uphold what the courts of appeals have done, and they're going to throw these laws out on their face, because these laws are not American laws. They're targeting people based on the color of their skin. And in this country, the color of the skin should not be an indicator of how legal a person is.
That was David Leopold, immediate past president of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. For more information on challenges to state immigration laws, visit our website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut, 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.